Hi, I'm Haley Brennan, and you're listening to the New Narratives in History of Philosophy podcast. Today, I'll be talking with Lisa Shapiro about the New Narratives Project.
Hello.
Hi, Lisa. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you, Haley?
I'm doing good. So, let's get started.
Okay. My name is Lisa Shapiro. I'm professor of philosophy at Simon Fraser University, and I am the principal investigator of the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project, funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada.
Can you tell me a little bit about the New Narratives Project?
Yeah, so the New Narratives Project is just what it says it is. We're interested in trying to reinvigorate the philosophical canon. Why does the philosophical canon need to be reinvigorated? Well, in North America, the same seven people who all happen to be European males have been being taught as a standard part of the curriculum for over 100 years now. And the story is getting a bit stale, for one. And for another, we realized that a whole lot of people who were doing really interesting philosophical work are left out of the story. And so students and indeed researchers don't really know that much about them. So we're trying to bring these figures to light, many of whom are women, and bring the philosophical issues that they were concerned with to light, and just let people know about them and see what kinds of new storylines emerge.
And so you mentioned that the story is getting stale, and so you think a way of reinvigorating and exciting the story again is introducing these new figures. What ways does it excite the philosophical canon other than just new voices?
Well, when you start reading these non-canonical figures, what begins to become clear is the larger context in which the familiar figures like Descartes and Leibniz and Spinoza and Locke and Berkeley and Hume and Kant were writing. And once you get a better sense of that context, you get a sense of what the real philosophical debates were about. So rather than taking the philosophical positions as fixed and something to be learned and memorized, you realize that there was a lively debate in the 17th and 18th centuries. And in those lively debates, real substantive philosophical questions were wrestled with. And they're not unlike the kinds of issues that we're still wrestling with today. So it reinvigorates the canon by bringing to life voices that have gone silent, but also by bringing to life the topics and issues and the context that we've neglected.
Can you give me an example?
So my favorite—
Lisa and I discuss and give the names of some particular figures later in the interview.
One of the standard issues that we teach in an early modern philosophy course is about the changing nature of the mind. And we look in particular to Descartes' account of the mind as involving consciousness and awareness of oneself as a thinking thing. So you get the familiar claim that I am a thinking thing, or that I think, therefore I am, that brings to the forefront this idea that what it is to think is to be aware of oneself and one's thoughts. When you start looking at the way that idea gets taken up, it's an idea that is about awareness and consciousness, but it's also about the idea of owning one's own thoughts, of having one's own thoughts belong to the thinker. And in the 17th century context, that gets taken up by women in particular, as well as others, men, as well as women, around how it is you can teach someone to come to own their own thoughts rather than simply repeating what authorities tell them. You know, we all know how to learn by rote and get tested on what people who are smarter than us thought and whether we repeat those ideas correctly or not. And in the 17th century, that was a big part of education. But through the idea of owning one's own thoughts, you come to see that it's a big innovation in the period that you don't just learn by being able to repeat what your epistemic authorities tell you. but to be able to make those ideas your own and to truly understand them so that you can explain them to other people as well as to explain them to yourself, to know the reasons for them for yourself. And this is particularly interesting for women thinkers because that owning of their own thoughts is tied to a kind of asserting their own moral authority and thereby also their political authority. So if women can think for themselves, they ought not be subject to their fathers, their husbands. They can actually go out and make decisions for themselves and own their actions as well as their own thoughts.
So in bringing to light these new narratives and in focusing on these neglected figures, it sounds like what you're saying is not only are you bringing to light these figures, but you're also bringing to light new ways of learning and new ways of teaching. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do is bring to light not only new figures, but a new way of thinking about the philosophical issues or the questions that drive philosophical work. And so shaking up the canon is also a matter of really introducing new figures who haven't been taught in courses before, but also of really thinking about what's at issue with the central ideas. So it's still the case that thinking and what the nature of thought is a central issue, but you can tweak the question or better understand what the issue is in the period. And so for us, right? And so make the question our own rather than just accept the questions we've been given.
And you mentioned political thought and social and moral aspects of, for example, this way of thinking and the way of going about doing philosophy. Would you say in looking at new narratives and in expanding the canon, we have a more holistic approach to the history of philosophy?
So I think actually two things. I think one of the things that attracted me to the history of philosophy rather than contemporary. So I went to graduate school thinking I would do something in contemporary philosophy of science, but I ended up doing history of philosophy precisely because when you look at the history of philosophy, you have to read around a lot and not just focus on a small set of questions, but focus most of the figures, whether they're canonical or non-canonical, that we still read today, didn't just focus on a small set of questions. They focused on a wide range of questions and saw themselves as doing philosophy in a systematic way so that their answers to questions about the nature of thought were tied to questions about the nature of agency. And the nature of agency is tied to the nature of morality and what counts as good and bad. So that's one of the general attractors, I think, of working in the history of philosophy. One of the things, though, that I do think this project is committed to is not just taking the philosophical works of the period as isolated from everything that's going out in that historical era. Rather, it's seeing the practice of philosophy, of doing philosophy, as occurring in a particular social and historical context. And having that context shed light on the philosophical ideas. That's actually been a way of approaching the history of philosophy that's been in play for, I would say, at least 30 years or so, insofar as there was a real move to situate the history of philosophy within the history of science, the history of the early modern period in particular, within the context of the scientific revolution that's happening in the 17th and 18th centuries as well.
You're mentioning, right, that part of history of philosophy is situated in its time period, in its social setting. So in developing new narratives, are you concerned with the new figures doing philosophy? Or are you also looking at figures who may have not been considered as doing philosophy, but have a social and historical impact that fits into the philosophy of the period?
Okay, that's a great question. I think one of the things that this project is bringing out is that the lines that separate philosophy from non-philosophy are really blurry. So one of the things we're running up against is a question of whether a novel, say, could count as a philosophical text or a play could count as a philosophical text. A lot of the women that we're looking at wrote a lot of fiction. So for instance, on the French side, someone like Madeleine de Scudéry wrote novels, wrote conversations on moral topics, for instance. Someone like Margaret Cavendish wrote lots and lots of plays, poems, epistolary novels called Philosophical Letters. And they're clearly playing with genres. We have a tendency to just assume in the contemporary period that philosophy comes in a particular form, like a treatise or an essay. And one of the things this project does is challenge us to look a little bit more widely at different styles of writing and to really think about where the boundary between philosophy, say, and fiction, on the other hand, where that boundary lies. And I don't think that's a question that's easy to answer, but thinking about the answer, you learn more about what you think philosophy actually is. I think we can have an interesting discussion with a variety of answers to that question.
So what are some ways that the New Narratives Project is trying to open up the discussion? What are the methods you think you're providing for people to participate?
Well, one of the things we're doing is developing this podcast series. And what we're hoping to do with the podcast is to first introduce novices, students, and people in general to philosophical figures they haven't heard about before, to tell them a little bit about those figures, and to have conversations with people who are starting to do research on those figures or who have already done a fair amount of research on those figures to explain to us what they find interesting philosophically and otherwise. So we're hoping our listeners get both information and perspective on these figures that they haven't heard about before, and then be motivated to read about them for themselves. We need to figure out a mechanism for them to then reply back to us and to engage in conversation with us about what they're finding interesting. We do have a Facebook page where listeners can post their questions and responses and thoughts in response to what they're listening. And hopefully we'll have other avenues where people can share their impressions with us.
For making this podcast series, there's a Facebook page. Hopefully we're putting in place resources for people whose interest has been piqued already. But do you have any particular figures or even any particular questions to ask to get people on board with this project to say, hey, there are these other people that we should be reading, these new narratives we should be studying?
Yeah, so let me just throw out some suggestions and leave it to people, pull a page out of Descartes and say, well, here's what I learned, and I'll leave it to you to decide what you'd like to take up for yourselves. So some of the really interesting women that I've been reading that I've found really interesting include Marie de Gournay, who was Michel de Montaigne's adopted daughter. Of course, Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia, the correspondent of Descartes. Margaret Cavendish, Duchess of Newcastle, who was very prolific and has some really interesting philosophical work related to debates around the nature of causation and political philosophy as well. Mary Estelle, an English thinker who Jacqueline Broad has written a book recently characterizing her as a virtue theorist, who appropriates Descartes' epistemology towards developing a kind of systematic virtue theory, which also argues for women's autonomy. So on the French side, I'm becoming more interested in Madeleine de Scudéry, who was also a prolific writer of fiction, but who seems to have lots of nuanced discussions around issues in moral psychology, and in particular about the passions and the role of the passions in moral psychology. And Gabrielle Souchon, who only wrote two books, very long books in French, but is a very interesting social theorist. And her epistemology, she's really interested in the status of authority, whether that's epistemic authority or moral authority, and the way in which women in particular are excluded from having both epistemic and moral authority, and her criticism of that on the grounds that deprivation of authority is problematic because it constrains women's freedom. So she's, I think her critique is incredibly sophisticated and reads to be very modern. She's very interesting in that regard. Moving forward into the 18th century, there's a lot of people working right now on Emilie du Châtelet, another French woman who was the translator of Newton's Principia into French, and who, along with that translation, wrote a preface that is a very sophisticated piece of philosophy of science. She also wrote a kind of physics textbook of her own, which was meant to teach her son physics, and that has a lot of philosophy of science in it as well. But she also had interests in moral philosophy and wrote on moral philosophy and happiness in particular. And there are, you know, there's many, many more names that I could list, which I think more brings home just how impoverished our own understanding of our intellectual historical past has been just by focusing on the seven men that we have focused on for the past 100 years.
It sounds like not only is it just impoverished because we've ignored several of these figures, but just you're talking about Du Châtelet and Duchamp on authority. I mean, questions of authority and philosophy of science aren't typically, in my understanding, questions that we discuss when we talk about the early modern period. So it's not only is there opportunity to learn more figures, but to pursue interests, like you mentioned, contemporary interests that people might have and see their origins in the history of philosophy in ways that we haven't really acknowledged before.
I think that's certainly true. I think Du Châtelet is particularly interesting because I guess in the relatively recent past, there has been a turn to looking at the philosophy of science in the early modern period because of its interconnection with the history of science. Hmm. But until even more recently, until the past few years, people haven't been looking at Du Châtelet, even though they have been interested in Newton. So once you start shaking things up a bit, it begins to emerge just how much we've neglected in our intellectual history by not contextualizing the kinds of philosophical questions around what the nature of what exists, around the nature of the good, that have been framed very broadly. But those questions get raised in a particular historical context, and how they get answered is in many ways shaped by the particular historical context in which they get asked. So looking at the historical context complicates things, but in a good way. The nice thing about complexity is that you don't need to see everything or hear everything all at the same time. So we're hoping that these podcasts will just provide little snippets of conversation about the ideas of figures that you might not have heard of before.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. This was really interesting. And I look forward to hearing more and learning more about all these new narratives and these new figures in the history of philosophy. Thank you for listening to the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. The New Narratives Project and podcast are funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. In the spirit of the project, the music for the podcast is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonice. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net, and follow us on Facebook. We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.